The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service and the Associated Press. Our first article was published by the Religion News Service on October 12 and written by Yonant Shimron. Racked by grief, U.S. Jews gather to mourn, lament, and raise money for Israel. At synagogues, public squares, and on Zoom, U.S. Jews in every part of the country have been gathering to pray, grieve, and comfort one another in the wake of Hamas' devastating attack, which has killed more than 1,200 people in Israel and spurred retaliatory action in Gaza. From New York to San Diego, and in many places in between, Jews standing in solidarity with their Israeli brothers and sisters lit candles, recited psalms, and stood up to sing the Israeli national anthem, Hatikvah. The Hader Institute in New York's Upper West Side, a Jewish study center, declared on Thursday, October 12, a day of communal fasting, to which hundreds of prominent rabbis signed on. The Hamas attack is being described by many as Israel's 9/11, though proportionally, it has been far deadlier and is equivalent to the deaths of 43,000 American lives. By contrast, 2,996 Americans died in the terrorist attacks of 9/11. Additionally, about 150 hostages are believed to have been taken by Hamas. As many historians have pointed out, Sunday's attack may also have been the worst day for Jewish casualties since the Holocaust. Many American Jews have felt an acute sense of trauma, too. They have family or friends in Israel and visit frequently. Racked by grief, they are feeling anger and despair. We exist in a liminal space, on the edge, waiting for the pieces to fit again, said Rabbi Scott Looper of Temple Beth Or in Montgomery, Alabama, speaking at a service of comfort sponsored by the Jewish Federation of Central Alabama. Many Jews are also bracing for a backlash. While global sympathies are overwhelmingly with Israel in the aftermath of the attacks, that has begun to change as Israeli airstrikes pound Gaza in a retaliation. Already, more than 1,400 Palestinians have been killed as part of the Israeli retaliation, and 300,000 are estimated to be homeless. On Thursday, October 12, Columbia University closed its campus to the public ahead of a planned protest against the Israeli bombardment of Gaza. And one day after, a 24-year-old Israeli student was beaten in front of a library on campus, the New York Times reported. At the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, students protested for Palestine on the steps of Wilson Library on Thursday. And on Friday, an International Day of Action for Palestine is planned for New York City's Times Square. Finding the right balance between anger at Hamas and empathy for Palestinian suffering will be challenging. I think we're all in for a very dark time, and certainly voices that are speaking out for human rights and for shared Arab-Jewish society are going to face tremendous challenges in Israel, said Daniel Sakech, CEO of the New Israel Fund, a group that raises money with the goal of making Israel a more equal and democratic society. Finding people to listen to them in a moment where, understandably, the whole country feels brutalized and furious will be hard. American Jews are raising tens of millions of dollars to support victims and their families. On Thursday, the Jewish Federations of North America announced it was launching a $500 million campaign to support Israel. It has already allocated $10 million for Israeli groups that provide medical care, transportation, housing, trauma relief, and psychological support. Sokatch said the New Israel Fund has also received a surge of donations for victims, whether Israeli, Israeli Arab, or Bedouin. On a Zoom prayer call with the conservative Jewish movement's worldwide arm, Rakefet Ginsburg, executive director of the Masorti Foundation for Conservative Judaism, said many Israelis feel utterly abandoned by the institutions that are supposed to protect them. It took as many as 20 hours for Israeli soldiers to arrive to defend Israelis hiding from Hamas terrorists on Saturday. All the support systems that we as a nation had inside this country collapsed, Ginsburg said during a prayer service attended by nearly 800 people. The feeling is like we're orphans. One day we woke up and we understood that nobody is taking responsibility for us. In this moment, she said, American solidarity and support is critical. You know, when we talk about trauma, one of the most traumatic things is that you're alone, she said. Knowing that we're not lonely right now and we have people with us, that's a huge help. While many Israelis and American Jews are feeling hopeless or angry, some in the U.S. Jewish community are also calling for renewed commitment to justice. TIRA, a rabbinic human rights organization representing over 2,300 rabbis and cantors in North America, on Thursday cautioned the Israeli military to adhere to international law in Gaza and expressed concern for civilians who lack food, water, and medical supplies. It also called for the release of Israeli hostages in Gaza. We are deeply disturbed by these individuals, including some members of the Israeli government and a few American Jewish protesters caught on camera calling for brutal revenge on the people of Gaza, said Jill Jacobs, the chief executive of TIRA. In our mourning, fear, and despair, we cannot lose our humanity. Now a related article published by the Associated Press on October 16, entitled, Six-Year-Old Boy is Buried and Mother Treated After Attack That Police Call an Anti-Muslim Hate Crime, by Sophia Tarin and Ed White. Chicago. A 71-year-old Illinois landlord, upset over the Israel-Hamas war, attacked a Palestinian-American woman with a knife when she proposed they pray for peace, and killed her six-year-old son, authorities said on October 16. The details emerged as Joseph Chuba appeared in court on murder, attempted murder, and hate crime charges, while the boy's Muslim family prepared to bury him in the Chicago area. Detectives were able to determine that both victims in this brutal attack were targeted by the suspect due to them being Muslim and the ongoing Middle Eastern conflict involving Hamas and the Israelis, the sheriff's office said. The boy's mother told investigators that she rents two rooms on the first floor of the Plainfield home, while Chuba and his wife live on the second floor, Assistant State's Attorney Michael Fitzgerald said in a court filing. He was angry at her for what was going on in Jerusalem, Fitzgerald said. She responded to him, "Let's pray for peace." Chuba then attacked her with a knife. The boy's mother fought him off and went into a bathroom where she stayed until police arrived. Wadia, meanwhile, was in his own room. Wadia should be heading to school in the morning. Instead, his parents will wake up without their son, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker said in a written statement. Jewish and Muslim groups have reported an increase of hateful rhetoric in the wake of the war. We are not animals. We are humans, said the boy's uncle, Yusef Hanan. We want people to see us as humans, to feel us as humans, to deal with us as humans. Police found Chuba with a cut on his forehead, sitting on the ground outside the home. The public defender's office did not immediately return messages seeking comment about the charges against him. Chuba's wife, Mary, told police that her husband feared they would be attacked by people of Middle Eastern descent, and had withdrawn $1,000 from a bank in case the U.S. grid went down. The Justice Department said it opened a hate crime investigation into the attack. This horrific act of hate has no place in America and stands against our fundamental values, freedom for fear, for how we pray, what we believe, and who we are, President Joe Biden said. Chuba, a Plainfield resident, replied, "Yes, sir," when asked if he understood the charges and was subsequently returned to jail in Joliet, 50 miles southwest of Chicago. A Will County judge granted a court-appointed lawyer. Wadia L. Fayoum, who had just turned 6, had been stabbed multiple times when sheriff's deputies discovered him Saturday in response to a 9/11 call. Our next article was published by Religion News Service on October 11 and written by Jack Jenkins, entitled, "New Award Honors Tim Keller and Sister Norma Pimenta for Civic Renewal." Washington. The Reverend Timothy Keller, an evangelical Christian theologian who died earlier this year, and Catholic nun Sister Norma Pimenta, known for her work with migrants, have been chosen by a Christian organization to be the first recipients of its Civic Renewal Award. The awards are being given by the Center for Christianity and Public Life, a group founded last year by a former official from President Barack Obama's administration and dedicated to furthering the credibility of Christian resources for the public good. Offered at the group's inaugural summit next month, the prize is meant to honor Christians who show exemplary contributions to the health and well-being of their communities and nation. When the public thinks of Christian leadership, they should think of Christians who serve the public, like Sr. Norma Pimenta and Tim Keller, Michael Ware, founder and head of the CCPL, said in a statement. Ware, an evangelical Christian who helped lead Obama's campaign faith outreach efforts, as well as working in the then president's White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships, is known for operating at the intersection of religion and politics, often among Democrats. He wrote a book on the topic, Reclaiming Hope, Lessons Learned in the Obama White House About the Future of Faith in America, and previously worked as a political consultant whose clients included religious groups. In an interview, Ware praised Keller, the founder and longtime pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City, a megachurch affiliated with the Presbyterian Church in America. Ware singled out Hope for New York, a faith-based group associated with Keller that helps assemble resources to support nonprofit organizations serving the poor and marginalized in New York City. Keller, Ware said, transformed the way many pastors of many churches thought about the city. A co-founder of the Gospel Coalition, Keller was long associated with conservative Christianity, but his self-described winsome approach to ministry has more recently been criticized by some of his fellow evangelicals as too non-confrontational during a time when, they argue, America has become hostile to Christianity. Keller also came under fire from some conservative Christians for expressing skepticism about former President Donald Trump. Keller died in May at age 72 after a prolonged struggle with pancreatic cancer. CCPL officials also lauded Pimenta for her tireless efforts in serving and advocating for the marginalized and vulnerable, saying her commitment to compassionate and selfless service exemplifies the values at the core of CCPL's mission. She rose to prominence in 2014 when she helped organize a respite center run by Catholic Charities along the U.S.-Mexico border. that offered aid to migrants after they were released by Border Patrol. Initially, support for Pimenta's work extended across political and religious divisions, earning her praise from Republicans, Democrats, and even the Pope, with some referring to her as Pope Francis's favorite nun. In 2018, she was awarded the Latour Medal from the University of Notre Dame, seen by many as the highest honor in the U.S. Catholic Church. Our next article was published by the Religion News Service on October 11 and written by Claire Giangrave. Synod on Synodality finds its voice after Pope Francis enforces silence. Vatican City. The first rule of the Synod on Synodality: don't talk about the Synod on Synodality. The long-awaited month-long summit of Catholic cardinals, bishops, priests, and laypeople, called by Pope Francis to address the biggest challenges facing the Church, has been wrapped in a veil of silence, or, as the Pope calls his gag order on participants, fasting, from discussing what is going on inside the plenary sessions and small groups at the Vatican. In his inaugural address to the 364 Synod participants and the theologians and other experts on hand to guide them, Francis called for a certain type of fasting of the public word to protect the spiritual conversations that he hopes will overcome the Church's polarization. Francis later declared that the Church is taking a break so it can turn its gaze inward to resolve the issues it faces. What little has been said, even from the Synod's most vociferous critics, has been muted. On October 5, a former Vatican doctrine czar, Cardinal Gerhard Mueller, spoke briefly about the Synod to EWTN, the conservative Catholic news network based in the United States, saying only, "The experience at the table was very good, therefore I have some form of optimism," and adding that the end will be determined by the decisions behind the scenes. Francis' decision to put a lid on the Synod came at the last minute before it convened, surprising the Church's public relations officials, who were left with the impossible task of putting a positive spin on a secret synod. As an institution as large as the Church is giving itself a moment for common discernment in silence, listening, faith, and prayer, said Paolo Ruffini, who heads the Vatican's communications department, during a briefing to journalists on Thursday. Part of the Pope's motivation may be to give the Synod's participants a safe space to express themselves on delicate topics put before them by Catholics in parishes around the world, who contributed to drafting questions for the Synod. Those topics range from sexuality and LGBTQ inclusion in the Church to female ordination and priestly formation, accountability for sexual abuse, and reform of power structures in the Church. According to the Reverend David McCallum, executive director of the Church's Discerning Leadership Program and one of the guides at the Synod, the Pope's boundary on speaking outside the Synod protects the participants from influences that would in some way, shape, or form co-opt the conversation or try to influence it ideologically. By closing the doors to the Synod Hall, McCallum added, the Pope ensured that small interest groups cannot interfere. But the Jesuit priests admitted that it comes at a price. When people don't get information, they either assume the worst or create completely ungrounded expectations, he said. There are risks, of course, no matter which course the Vatican Press Office goes. Previous synods under Francis have been hijacked by public opinion and the media's tendency to focus on hot-button issues such as married priests or allowing communion for divorced and remarried Catholics. But shutting the doors can also backfire, allowing radicals to grab attention, such as when a right-wing activist tossed a sacred Amazonian image into the Tiber River during the 2019 Synod on the Amazon region. The official rules of the Synod mandate that each of the participants is bound to confidentiality and discretion regarding both their own intervention and the intervention of other participants. So far, the rule has proved quite effective without having to apply a formal ban known as pontifical secrecy on the gathering, which would allow violators to be excommunicated. Ruffini clarified that the rule of discretion is encouraged, but those who blab should not fear that Vatican police officers will come knocking at their door. But obeying the Pope's request and staying mum has become a way of signaling allegiance to Francis and the Synod process itself. 1 week into the Synod, the debates and side chatter that could be heard in the days leading to the event have fallen silent. The host of Catholic commentators, activists, and intellectuals in the Eternal City continue to gossip, and occasionally some of what is being discussed in the Circoli Minori, the small working groups at the Synod, leaks out off the record. But real news is in short supply, and the newspapers have little to report. But the Synod has yet to gather momentum, with substantive debates, particularly the question of how much LGBTQ Catholics should be welcomed in the Church, only just starting, some participants told RNS. The topic of women's ordination and the female diaconate has yet to come up in earnest. Not only the content of the debates, but the format is unfamiliar to Catholic prelates, who are used to having the final word, usually in private, and sharing only what they wish. As Mueller noted in his interview with EWTN, the nature of the Synod has changed, with lay people being allowed to have a decisive vote on the future of the Church. But change is also happening inside the Synod itself, with new ideas and positions being heard as the process gets underway. It's messy and complicated, said McCallum, who added that the summit feels like a sacred space at the table, during the liturgies, and even at the line for coffee. Our last piece is an excerpt from an article published by Religion News Service on October 6th, written by Adele M. Banks and Yonat Shimron, entitled, Black Churches Play a Key Role in Connecting Communities to Broadband Internet. In the riverfront city of New Bern, North Carolina, Palita Ministries, like many houses of worship since COVID-19 struck, offers Sunday services to those who can't get to church for health or other reasons. But in these days of Zoom and other internet-based communications, the stay-at-home congregants still dial in to the service via a conference call on the ministry's toll-free 800 number, a landline. People still call it, and they still do church services that way, said Don Baldwin Gibson, the ministry's executive director. They still do their Bible studies that way. A lot of people just don't have devices in their homes, or they don't have access to the internet. Early in the pandemic, Black churches often struggled to make the switch to remote services for lack of broadband in their area. Even if a church had the wherewithal to live stream services or hold meetings on video platforms, congregants lack the connections to take advantage. A 2020 Pew Research Center study showed that while 92% of evangelical Christians and 86% of mainline Protestants could watch services online, only 73% of worshipers in the historically Black traditions said the same. Today, in the rural South, 38% of Black households do not have access to broadband, compared with 23% of white households, according to the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. Black clergy and faith leaders in the rural South have been working for years to bridge the digital divide in their communities and congregations. And a pandemic-era federal program gave those efforts a boost by offering discounted internet access. But fewer than half of the estimated 49 million Americans who were eligible have enrolled, and now questions loom about the program's long-term funding by Congress. The Federal Communication Commission's Affordable Connectivity Program offers discounted internet access and one-time discounts on laptop, desktop, or tablet purchases. Any household whose income amounted to less than 200% of the federal poverty line qualifies, as do those earning above that line but who receive any of a variety of public benefits. To date, more than 21 million households have enrolled in the program. In North Carolina, the state's Department of Information Technology has set a goal of enrolling 1 million state residents in the ACP by year's end, said Crystal H. Dickerson, spokesperson for the department's Broadband and Digital Equity Division. So far, more than 850,000 households have signed up. To that end, it is partnering with faith-based organizations such as Paletta to get the word out. Other faith networks, including the Balm in Gilead and the National African American Clergy Network, as well as national black denominations, are working on these efforts, which include pleas to members of Congress to replenish funding for the program, which could be depleted by early 2024. Governor Roy Cooper has also encouraged internet service providers in the state to lop an additional $30 from the monthly fees of individuals who qualify for the ACP. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.